door, which causes it to creak open a crack. The latch bolt wasn't all the way in its housing. Pushing the door open further, I say his name and knock lightly on the frame. I don't hear him. The house is quiet. Stepping inside, I say, "Declan?" My fingers paw the wall, feeling for a switch. I'm looking for my phone. The side of my hand bumps a lamp, and I turn it on by feel. The room isn't anyone's bedroom. It's an enormous study with a giant round table and six heavy chairs. A framed sepia map covers one wall from the ceiling down to the top of a couch. Within a mounted display box over a desk, there's a rusty iron javelin tip that looks 1,000 years old. Wow. Did they send a tomb raider to rob an archaeological dig site? Or can people like the Hayworths simply buy ancient antiquities whenever the urge hits? Walking to the round table, which is tucked into a nook, I'm greeted by a silkscreen of a medieval knight in a brass helmet. The colors are a mix of bronze, charcoal, crimson, and navy. It's not the trim, gallant knight of the GU logo. This knight is broad-shouldered and menacing. And I'm completely drawn to him on a base level. Unable to take my eyes off the print, I have an almost irresistible urge to steal it. Not that this thug of a knight belongs among my whimsical dandelion prints. It absolutely does not. And yet I'm so enthralled. I could take it and build a new decor around it. "What are you doing in here?" I jerk so hard my bones vibrate. "Oh my God," I say, clutching my chest where my heart is suddenly pounding. Turning sharply, I find Declan standing a few feet from me. His scowl causes a groove to form between his brows. "I was looking for my phone and thought you might have taken it upstairs with you. I came in here thinking it was a bedroom." "As you can see, it's not." He beckons me out. "Did you pick the lock?" "Of course not. When I knocked, the door swung open." His jaw clenches, which doesn't make it any less pretty. "This map looks interesting. How old is it?" "Are you kidding right now?" His lips purse. "Get over here. You know you're not supposed to be upstairs." Strolling slowly across the room, I steal a longer glance at the antique map. I think it's the original GU campus. There's an X marked in the center that I'm dying to examine more closely. Is there buried treasure? Or a dark secret concealed for over a century? A suspicion creeps into my mind and plants roots. There is one famous GU legend. I stop in front of the map, which causes Declan to stalk over and take my arm in his big hand. He pulls me away, but not before I spot the old well. This map is definitely Granthorpe, and stamped next to the well is a bronze knight's helmet that matches the faceplate armor of the silkscreen knight. My eyes jerk down to the corner where the map is signed and dated, Daniels, 1908. Sometime after the map was hand-drawn, someone added a stamp to it, one of a dark knight. Declan half lifts, half propels me into the hall. "They're still at GU, aren't they?" I say, putting a finger against his rib. "It's not just an urban legend. The Dark Knights existed, and they still do." His scowl is thunderclouds and lightning. "No. No? You're saying they don't exist?" "It's too early for this, Cameron." Not a denial. He yanks the door closed. Checking to ensure the latch catches, he bangs a fist against the door. This time, it doesn't swing open. "Declan!" "No. No more questions. One. Just one. No," he growls. "So that's it then. The knights exist," I whisper, my eyes widening. "And you're one of them."
Chapter 30. Declan. Fuck fate and all its bullshit. I noticed an issue developing with the latch on the war room door. With a girl living in the house, I should have double-checked it. Now she's seen too much. My family was involved in the school's founding and early construction, I say, trying to cover. We have keepsakes and memorabilia. Cameron arches a brow, and there's a part of me that wants to come clean with her, which is crazy since she's the last person I could confide in about the Dark Knights. I like history. Can you show me your family's collection? Maybe sometime. I lie. Guiding her the rest of the way down the hall, I push my bedroom door open. Your phone's on the nightstand. I grabbed it by mistake.
Uh-huh.
She says with skepticism that's completely warranted. Our phones look nothing alike. She strolls over to the king-size bed, studying the gray, washed wood headboard.
A bed fit for a king, she says. Naturally.
I'm silent. She strolls a little farther and pauses to admire the Chagall over a chest of drawers. Exhaling a wistful sigh, she says, "This house has such an incredible art collection. That one's mine personally." I'm glad she's admiring the painting. I want to distract her from the Knights' War Room. Chagall was my mom's favorite. She owned this piece. We especially loved its giant glowing moon. Cameron leans closer.
It's beautiful. The glow effect is amazing.
When I was young, my mom sometimes tossed cushions on the floor, and we'd lie under the painting. She had a cast iron fondue pot that she would set in the center of a large marble cutting board. We'd have charcuterie first, then marshmallows and fruit dipped in dark chocolate fondue. She called it camping. Cameron looks over her shoulder at me with a smile.
Roughing it billionaire style, I guess. There's a name for that now. It's called glamping. Though I think the fancy air-conditioned tents are in the actual wilderness, not a giant mansion.
Extra rustic, then. She laughs.
Exactly.
Maybe you and I will do that for a weekend. Sounds like a good way to ease myself in. My team wants to go on a week-long hike in spring, and there's a lot of pressure for me to be there. She picks up her phone and holds it aloft.
Did you go through this?
Would I do that?
I'm sure you would. The better question is, why did you?
Were you worried I'd taken intimate pictures of you? I nod, glad she came up with a good excuse for me. I'd planned to put her phone back before she noticed it was gone.
And were you satisfied? Or disappointed when you didn't find any pictures of your naked junk?
Satisfied. Dick pics are trashy.
You never send them?
Never. My dick goes to private parties only.
Kind of a shame since he's so noteworthy.
I laugh.
Did you peek into my files?
She asks.
No.
I lie. I more than peeked. I read them. Her notes on the Dark Knights were well researched and organized, but there was nothing that would be dangerous for the society. And my uncle had zero mentions on the device, all of which means there's no reason for the alumni to hurt her. I'm glad to see that. But the lingering questions remain. Who's targeting her and why? Is it really just an obsessed fan? She says. Savvy as always.
Not sure I believe you, but I'm going to trust that if you did read the docs, you won't leak details to rival reporters.
I'd never betray you, Cameron. That you can count on. Looking up from her phone, her eyes lock on my face.
Same.
That one word hits me way north of my cock, somewhere in the vicinity of my heart. A look passes between us that has nothing to do with our dirty first meeting and subsequent arrangement. We're in uncharted territory. My subconscious has probably known it for a while. It's the only explanation for the way I hold on to her, despite how complicated things are getting. I know she's investigating the Dark Knights. I know she's cataloging things I say and wants to write feature articles about me. I should have evicted her from my life already. Instead, I've brought her into my bedroom for a sentimental chat about my childhood and a preview of upcoming nature excursions. What the fuck is going on with me? Yes, Cameron is beautiful. Yes, the sex is exceptional. But her family is a landmine. As are her curiosity and career choice. All right, nymph. Back downstairs. Stalling, she hesitates near my dresser,
looking into a tray of cufflinks and tie tacks. As usual, she's going to see what she can get away with. By all means, take your time, I say. But then don't complain when I bend you over the end of my bed and introduce your ass to a leather belt. Her head turns slowly to stare at me. You would not. I would. And you know it. Frowning, she narrows her eyes. I liked you better last night. I'm sure, I say wryly. Last night, Declan spoke French during a post-coital fugue state. That guy has no business showing up in the light of day, especially when she's snooping behind locked doors. Nothing compares to you. Yeah. What the fuck, Hayworth? All right, Rin, I say. Back downstairs where you belong. She shrugs and then strolls out of the room with a swish in her step that causes my gaze to drop to her tight little ass. I want my hands on that. And my cock inside it. Soon. I walk to the doorway and look out to be sure she doesn't go on a walkabout. She doesn't. She behaves, descending the stairs quickly and disappearing from view. No cause to strip her naked and force her over my lap for a firm punishment. Unfortunately.
Cameron. Downstairs, as I put on a black jersey maxi dress that reaches my ankles, I try to sort out my increasingly complicated feelings for Declan. Does he even notice he's using a nickname for me that he's made up? And a fairly pretentious one at that, Rin. Not sure how I feel about it. If it signals we're developing a rapport outside the bedroom, then I like it. Otherwise, I don't think so. Last night, we connected on a whole new level. Today, he's pushed me back into the sex toy zone. Sigh. Come on, Cammy, be realistic. He lives in a priceless museum. You can barely afford a latte some days. Right. Reality bites. Good reminder. I have today and 8 more before the sketchy arrangement is over, and I move on with my regularly scheduled life. Briggs arrives and makes me a strawberry cheesecake crepe, which makes everything seem better. I eat in the library while I go through email. A lot of my friends have heard rumors that I'm working for Declan, and there are a ton of questions about him, naturally. Everyone wants a piece, even if that piece is only gossip. Arrogant and gorgeous with a sex addiction is how I would describe him if I were answering emails about him honestly, which I'm not. Instead, I skip the personal messages and switch to emails related to the paper. Well, fuck, I mumble, when I open one with the subject line, gotta cancel. 3 of us from the dispatch were planning to go to Scribe Jam, a New York literary festival, and now the other 2 have bailed. I'd been hoping to slip into the party after the award ceremony to network. Cocking my head at the screen, I decide there's no way I can miss the festival, even if it means going alone. The other girls are concerned that being under 21 will keep us from getting into the mixers in local bars. But I'm sure we'll be able to get into some of them, and even if we can't, there will be students from NYU and Columbia hosting gatherings, I'm sure. Unfortunately, the dispatch girls are already making alternate plans, even before I've responded. That stings. I'm new to GU and the dispatch, but I'm working hard to prove myself. Frowning, I chew on my lip and fire off an email, making my argument for going. What's wrong? Looking up, I find Declan leaning against the library doorway. For once, he's dressed down, in jeans and casual V-neck shirt. Certainly still town and country worthy, but not so unapproachably billionaire boss. Nothing really, I say, wrinkling my nose. I'm trying to boss up and change my life, but my plans just took a hit. There's plenty of sauce and bravado in my tone. Bossing up through what mechanism? My brows rise, and when I speak, I take on a blue blood accent. Through what mechanism? Flashing him a smile, I point a finger in his direction. Do you know that you have a tendency to speak proper English, Not always, but on the whole, you have fewer end-of-sentence-hanging prepositions than anyone I've ever met. That's the benefit and the curse of a private prep school education. He strolls in and sits on the couch under the nymph painting. Tell me about your life-changing endeavor. I'm going to the Scribe Jam Literary Festival, alone, apparently, because my colleagues on the dispatch are faithless slackers who want to go to a themed sorority party instead of taking the train to New York with me. I lick my lips. I'm going to sneak into the awards after party, or try to. It'll be a good test of my skills at talking my way into places. Any decent investigative journalist needs that ability. Declan's lip curls in mock disapproval. For a girl with a lot of secrets, you're pretty determined to become a member of the press. I don't have a lot of secrets. I have one big secret. He's about 6'4" and likes to dictate the kind of undies a girl wears or doesn't wear. Cocking an eyebrow, I add, don't worry though. If I can't make it as a top-tier reporter, your training will help me with my backup plan of working in a brothel. He doesn't even crack a smile. His control of his features is diabolical. If he plays poker, he must clean up. Brothel, he says dryly. That's the word you're gonna go with? Oh, oops. Preposition hanging at the end. Watch yourself. It's casual Friday in Hayworth House. I chuckle. Careful. If you trot out some wit to impress me, I'll expect you to use it all the time. That earns me a small smile from him, which looks so good on his handsome face. That reminds me of something, he says. But never mind. Back to your party crashing. Tell me the stratagem. Wait. Tell me what you were going to say. I lean forward, putting a hand on his arm. What did it remind you of? My tone's earnest. A little too earnest. Cringe. Clearing his throat, he shrugs. Shane, Eric, and I were having a night out. Shane was fairly lit and telling funny stories, as he often does. Eric and I were not contributing much at the time. He challenged Eric to step up his game, and Eric said, why direct that at me alone? What about Declan? And Shane said, Declan doesn't need a sense of humor. He's got a trust fund the size of the GNP. No need to entertain company. He can just buy it. Unable to stop myself, I laugh. This from your best friend? That's harsh. Wearing a small smirk, he shrugs. I have loaned both of them money, so not wholly inaccurate. Rolling my eyes, I smile and pinch his arm. Still harsh. But don't worry, darling, you have other qualities. Yeah, I wasn't worried. His smug tone is laced with sexiness. He curls his arm away so I can't pinch it again. And then his hand catches mine and closes around it. A physical checkmate. Typical. Hey. My free fingers try to peel his fist open. Pretending not to notice my efforts, he tightens his grip so I don't succeed in prying his hand open. How committed are you to party crashing as a means of testing your reporting skills? My fingers pause. I mean, I really want to get into that party, so I'm pretty committed. There are at least two people who'll be there that I need to grovel before. Lucky them. His deep blue gaze steadies me a moment. Or you could be efficient and kill two birds with one stone. How so? His thumb strokes my skin. With Declan, pleasure's always mixed with a sexy threat, which is annoyingly exciting. You could grovel for me, and I could procure you an invitation to the after party. You think you could get me in? Yeah, of course. I can get you invited anywhere you'd like to go. A wave of pleasure courses through me, but I try not to let it show. All right, yes. And while you're at it, can you use your name and pretty face to get me a ticket to the awards show itself? Sure. Done. My smile widens to the length of a football stadium. Then it fades. Wait, what do you want in return for this show of generosity? The corner of his mouth twitches. I'll think of something. I'm certain you will, I say in a tone of mock recrimination. Will it involve bondage? Maybe. Why don't you show your gratitude right now by dropping to your knees and sucking my noteworthy cock? My brows shoot up. Are you kidding? Yes. His tone is so grave, I repeat my question. Yes, I'm kidding. After a beat, he adds, see? Wry sense of humor, occasionally. You're hilarious, I deadpan. But I can't keep from smiling. He even called back my use of noteworthy. Just like a humor writer would. I love that. A lot. As he leans forward, his hand releases mine, only to clutch a handful of my hair to pull my head back. I'll take a rain check on the blowjob. But I will take a kiss right now. My eyes widen in surprise. I thought our break from the rules only applied to last night. Rather than waiting for me to kiss him, Declan's mouth presses against mine. With his tongue sliding into my mouth, I feel the immediate heat that comes on when any part of him penetrates any part of me. I return the kiss, stroking his tongue with mine until he pulls back and takes a slow breath. We don't suck at that. He winks and licks his lips. Let's have breakfast together. Again, I have to think, what? Declan has so many barriers in place to help him remain impervious to flirting and sweetness. Since when is he willing to drop them for me? I already had breakfast, I say regretfully. Briggs made me a crepe. Then come and hang out while I eat. He waits, motioning for me to join him. It's the first time he's asked me to spend time with him outside of having sex. Playing it cool? I keep my tone light. Sure, if you want.
Chapter 31. Declan. Cameron and I sit on the bench, so we're facing the kitchen's work area. Briggs, finding himself with an audience, behaves like he's on the cooking channel. She engages with him, oblivious to the fact that she's not the one he's interested in impressing. But because she seems happy and entertained by his crepe-flipping skills, I wait until the crepe is plated to give him a suppressing look. He recognizes it immediately, hangs his apron on a stainless steel hook in the corner, and excuses himself. No sweet cream in that one? She asks, leaning over my crepe. She should know what's in it, since we watched him make it. Almond butter, shredded coconut, dried orange, and extra dark chocolate, I say. May I taste? Nodding, I watch her. She takes a bite, chews carefully with narrowed eyes, and then smiles. That's not as sweet as the one I had, but still pretty good. It needs more orange or regular chocolate chunks. Those are kind of bitter, I offer. Yeah, they remind me of black coffee. Cutting into the crepe, I take a bite. To me, the filling tastes perfect. It's European-level sweet, rather than American sweet. I read the piece you sent me, Walking the Walk. It was excellent, I say. But you're talented, and you made my actions seem noble, which is a generous take on things, considering you know what I'm really like. Sitting back against the cushion, I let my gaze weigh on her. But the GDD's readers don't know you've experienced my dark side. So to the outside world, I think the article will look like a girl with a crush wrote it, which would undermine your credibility. She sits back, staring off in the direction of the butcher's block as she contemplates this. Blowing out a breath, she nods. You could be right. It's too bad. There were some terrific lines in it. Cameron touches the tip of her tongue to her top lip. Studying her soft mouth makes me think about kissing it. And putting my cock in it. Turning toward me, she says, What did you just say? I said there were some lines that should see publication.
Oh.
Yeah. Glad you liked them. Heinrich cuts adjectives like he's trimming fat from a steak, but if a line is vivid without them, it stays. Usually. We all overwrite, trying to see what we can get through. She rests her arm on the table, and for a moment I picture it tied behind her back. My cock starts to harden. Professor Heinrich has been good for my work, she says, oblivious to the direction of my thoughts. Dipping a finger into an escaped dollop of almond butter studded with chocolate, she smirks. After sucking it from her fingertip, she says, The pieces I wrote in high school were full of white chocolate. Now that I'm used to dark chocolate,
White tastes way too sweet. Cheers to that. Will you harvest the good lines from the story for use elsewhere? Maybe. But probably not. She taps her temple with a wink. There are more where those came from. She is fucking adorable sometimes. Finishing the crepe, I slide my dish away. I'm glad we have our NDA to make things between us off the record. You're dangerously observant. Our bedroom activities are off the record forever and ever, amen. But if I learn something that pertains to stories I was working on independent of our time together, you need to understand I will pursue those leads. That wall map you've got, for instance, I think there might be some interesting things buried in it. Hold on. I say sternly, are you saying if you uncover something I'm keeping secret, you'll report it? Because that would be a breach of our agreement. She tips her head back, staring up at the glass pendant lights thoughtfully. Maybe. Not maybe, Cameron. It would be. The fucking NDA. Her lips part enough for a frustrated breath to escape. Yeah. Okay. I'll stay out of the map room. Fruit of the poisoned tree, as it were. Her gaze lowers to challenge mine. But the Dark Knights is a story I'm going back to once you and I are over. So if you've got things to hide, you'd better bury them deep, because I've got a shovel and I like to dig. It's my favorite thing. It takes effort to keep from smiling. The sexy, cute thing is out in force today. Are you sure digging is your favorite? My hand squeezes her thigh and inches upward. I thought your favorite thing was lying beneath me with all your pretty places stretched and very full. Splotches of pink appear on her cheeks, and she shoves the side of my calf with her bare toes. Leave me alone, Hayworth. That's never gonna happen. Not while I'm living here, anyway. Her arms reach for the ceiling in a long stretch. My gaze drops immediately to her tight nipples under the thin fabric of her shirt. Come on, I say, tugging on her leg. I need a shower. With a little water nymph to wash my back. Rolling her eyes, she slides down the bench and emerges from behind the table. Does your ankle still hurt? At times. Does it hurt now? Not particularly. Clucking her tongue, she gives me a slow appraisal. So you don't actually need help. Her eyes narrow slightly. You know, I don't have a lot of experience, Declan, but I think you might have a sex addiction. You should see someone to find out. It's my turn to roll my eyes. You know who has trouble with their sex addictions? Men who don't have pretty blonde sex slaves. Her sharp intake of breath is satisfying. At times, despite her innocence, she seems hard to shock. It could be an act. Ever since we started talking about her work, she's been trying to cultivate the persona of a seasoned reporter. As we walk through the kitchen, I catch her arm before she can escape. I'm serious about the shower. You're serious about everything, so I never doubted it. She smirks at me, and it hits me both below the belt and above. I navigate us to the downstairs guest shower. Again, despite her innocence, Cameron is more relaxed about being naked in the shower with me than any woman I've ever known. When she's behind me, she flicks my ass with a rolled-up washcloth. Looking over my shoulder at her, I suppress my smile. Careful. If this turns into that, your ass will end up redder than mine. She sticks out her tongue at me, and I can't help myself. I laugh. What's on your agenda today, Cameron?
Agenda?
We're on a school break, Declan. Unlike you. Boss babe, I don't have an itemized agenda. I've got a couple appointments. Sucks to be you, she teases, giving my ass a pinch. Don't interrupt me, I say sternly. And don't pinch. Folding her arms across her chest, she quirks a brow.
All right.
Go ahead, my lord. My fingers push back wet strands of her hair so I can see her whole face. After my meetings, let's go shopping.
For?
A dress for the Scribe Jam Awards dinner, for one.
I have a black cocktail dress that's New York literary event appropriate.
Sure, but it's not arriving on the arm of a Hayworth appropriate. I'm not sure when I decided I want to escort her to a party at some literary festival, but the words slip out before I can call them back.
How do you know my dress isn't up to Hayworth standards? She asks in a sassy tone. My brow quirks. I just know. Her eyes meet mine and twinkle with mischief. All right. Her gaze slides over me. I'll take conspicuous wealth for 200. I'm not sure what she means, but I nod as if I get the reference. I'm sure it's cute. They always are. When the arrangement is over, I begin. Pointing the shower head at her calves, she rinses away shower gel. Yes? Let's stay friends. Looking up, she smiles. And it's a heart stopper.
Yeah.
I'd like that.
Chapter 32. Declan. As we return to Hayworth House from our shopping excursion, Cameron pretends she's offended I didn't let her drive the Bugatti, which she calls the French Batmobile. That would break protocol, I say, carrying in the bags. I'm in control. Remember? Of all things. You have more issues than a newsstand, Hayworth. You're lucky you're so handsome, or no one would put up with you. I can't help but smile. She's been entertaining company all day. Shopping for myself is usually just one more appointment on my schedule that I handle as expeditiously as possible. Shopping with Cameron is an outing. Her banter and appreciation for the craftsmanship of couture dresses elevate the experience. I liked getting her comical texts from the dressing room, and when she found a piece she loved, I liked buying it for her. She sails past the guest room door. I'm starving. I'm gonna see if I can forage some food for us. Check with Briggs before foraging. Groceries may be earmarked for meals he has planned. Her head tilts. Your life is so strange. Do you ever just walk into the kitchen and grab something? Yeah. It's my kitchen. I grab snacks as needed. The Beethoven's Fifth Symphony ringtone I've assigned to my grandfather begins to play. Her brows rise. I'm not even going to ask. Cameron continues to the kitchen as I step into the front room. After setting the bags on the settee, I answer, approving video since my grandfather has enabled his afternoon, he says, leaning toward the screen. The small polo logo on his navy sweater comes into focus as the camera adjusts. Good afternoon, I say. The Matisse on the wall directly behind him usually hangs in my mother's Paris apartment. When anyone suggests changes to her home, I immediately veto the idea, so I'm not happy the piece has been moved to the U.S. I'll address that at the end of our call.
Versace, Declan. Since when?
My brows crowd each other in a moment of confusion, and then I realize he's noticed the shopping bags behind me. The irony of how alike he and I are is not lost on me. Those are not for me.
Nor for Eden Buchanan. When I played golf with Peter, he said there's been no reconciliation.
Peter is Eden's hyper-aggressive father. Sometimes when she displays her dominance, she reminds me of him. Is matchmaking really the best use of an executive's time? I ask.
Everyone notices how well-suited you are. Even strangers commented on what a striking couple you make. Smart. Athletic. Socially adroit and attractive. We can't imagine you'll find anyone who suits you more.
There are things I could explain, but it would mean breaking Eden's confidence, which I have no intention of ever doing. Time will tell. I say noncommittally.
The clothes aren't for Eden, so then who?
He asks. I wouldn't presume to shop for Eden. Like most women of our set, she's a world-class shopper who's in no need of help. I'm trying to evade. Not throw shade at Eden, but he seems to take it that way.
A well-put-together woman is always an asset.
He clears his throat.
Let's cut to the heart of things. There's a rumor circulating that you got your assistant pregnant. The girl fainted at a GU party.
The girl from the party is not pregnant.
Well, thank God for that.
His relief irritates me. Of course I'm not wishing for an unplanned pregnancy with Cameron. But she's not wholly unsuitable, and he does want an heir from me.
Brock says your new PA is the little chit who blackmailed you. What would possess you to let her get close to you?
Cameron isn't the one who extorted money from me.
The family is treacherous. which means deep down she is as well. Remove her from your life.
My brows rise. He's never been this prescriptive about my personal life. I'm capable of making my own decisions with regard to the people I have around me.
If you're resisting, your judgment is impaired. Have you made promises to the girl?
Of course not.
We're just passing some time together, so put my mind at ease by ending it.
He pauses, leaning back.
I've heard you haven't been to a single event at the business school this year.
It was football season. I've been busy.
Football season is over now.
And your application is pending.
I nod.
Attending their innovation summit is already on my January calendar.
Good man. Now back to the girl. You'll get rid of her?
When I don't answer, his voice hardens.
Do I need to remind you that Hayworth House is a family home that's on loan to you? It's unacceptable for you to move anyone into it without permission, especially a little side piece who will distract you from better prospects.
My muscles tighten and my scowl turns vicious. I can look for alternative housing.
You will not move from there,
he says sharply. That would imply a rift. Not acceptable.
I've told you what to do. I expect it to be done today, Declan.
A hardness seeps into my voice. I understand. There's no reason to fight this directive. It was always a temporary arrangement, but his tone grates on me. I'm not a kid, and no one has spoken to me like one in a very long time. If this was anyone else, I would clap back, or simply end the call. But my grandfather's been a father figure and mentor all my life, and his confidence in me is paving the way for me to ascend to the most powerful position in the family. His expression shifts, becoming less severe.
Does this represent a hardship?
No. My jaw clenches for a moment. I'm being honest when I say it's not a hardship, but it is a loss. There's over a week left on the arrangement, and I want every minute. I've had a fast fall from grace, I say. At breakfast in South Carolina, you told me I was a born leader, and that I should use the school break to celebrate the championship season. The corners of my grandfather's mouth curl down, but he speaks in a tone that's the warmest it's been since the start of the call.
You know I'm proud of you, Declan. Year after year, you exceed everyone's expectations, even mine. You deserve to celebrate your victory, of course you do. But you should do that with people you can trust, and in a way that respects the future and the legacy we're building for you. Nothing derails a man's life faster than a bad woman.
You don't know her. She's a GU student, too. One who's talented enough to write front-page articles for the Granthorpe Daily Dispatch. The competition to write for GDD is always fierce, but right now it's reached another level. The current faculty editor is a Pulitzer Prize winner.
She wouldn't be at Granthorpe without the money and influence her family extorted from ours.
That wasn't her. Don't delude yourself. She filled out the application. She had to have known strings were being pulled to get her in as a transfer student on short notice. Bullshit, I think bitterly. I want to keep arguing, but I close my mouth because there's no point. By now, my grandfather has had the Reynolds family investigated extensively to assess the threat they pose to me. It's clear he's made up his mind. I'll sort things out, I say tightly,
by ending them.
Yes,
good man. Listen, the weather's improved. Come to Palm Beach. Bring your friends. From here, we'll arrange a trip to the private island so you can relax without the whole world watching.
I'm not interested. What would be the point of going off-grid with friends? I only need privacy if Cameron is with me, which she won't be. I appreciate the call. My voice sounds as wooden as the floorboards as I shift into formal politeness. I hope the rest of your day goes well.
Yours as well.
His screen goes dark. Resting my phone on the edge of the windowsill, I close my eyes. With great power comes great responsibility. You know this. Rubbing the bridge of my nose, I try to focus on the positive. I stand to inherit the kind of power that other men only dream about. But even that thought isn't enough. A river of discontent washes over me. There is no holding it back at the moment.
The downside of being the heir to a celebrated fortune is I don't have the luxury of anonymity and privacy. And for a while now, I've been pretending that my secrets will never come to light. It's a dangerous gamble. One I can't afford anymore.
Cameron. Before I can rummage through the fridge, Briggs appears. To hold me over while he makes our lunch, he gives me a bowl of homemade chips seasoned with Old Bay. I eat them as I tell him about the shopping trip with Declan. They did everything but bow down to him, Briggs. Briggs swishes a spatula like it's a saber. That's the power of a platinum codger. Apparently so, I say with a chuckle. At first, I was like a mannequin he carried in from storage. Once he started talking, no one asked me a single thing. It was completely bananas. Did you complain? Not really. Mostly, I let them have their way with me, I say with a wink. I didn't want to ruin Declan's good time. Briggs chuckles. Declan appears in the doorway. When you finish lunch, Cameron, come to the front room. There's something we need to discuss. Turning stiffly, he walks away, leaving both of us to stare after him. Something's changed. The relaxed posture and smile are gone. He's back to the coolly formal Declan Hayworth he serves to the general public. Let me see what's up, I say, sliding from the bench. I hustle down the hall to the front room where he's standing at the windows. What is it? Something's come up. His posture is rigid as he moves to within a few feet of me. I'm going to be occupied. So our time will have to be cut short. I blink, not understanding. What do you mean? His mouth forms a grim line. I'm releasing you from our arrangement. As of now. My brows knit. This is a complete shift. All day, it felt like he was pulling me closer to him. Even though we weren't calling today a date, the Scribe Jam Awards party was certainly going to be one. What happened? I ask. His expression is stormy. Nothing worth mentioning. Are you regretting that we were out shopping together publicly? Because we can just... Cameron, stop. There's no need to troubleshoot. There's nothing to fix. This was a temporary situation and now it's over. I'm calling an end to things a little early. But you fulfilled your obligation, so the debt is forgiven. My heart constricts painfully. I wasn't worried about the money. After the whirlwind way I was sucked into Declan's life, I guess I should have expected to be jettisoned out of it just as quickly. But I didn't. Just like that, I mutter. Are we still going to be friends? Am I free to hang out here with you the way Shane and Eric Sorensen do? His jaw grinds, and his silence speaks for him. Running a hand through my hair, I scowl. So, no, then. I want us to stay in touch. But for now, there are some other things I need to attend to. Got it. Turning on my heel sharply, I start to walk away. Hang on, he says, grabbing my arm. Looking pointedly at his hand and then up at his face, I raise an eyebrow. His voice is low but resolute. You and I have a chemistry that is noticeable. We need a cooling off period before we'll be ready to engage as friends. Sure. My voice is cool. Detached, Hayworthy. He sighs and lowers his voice farther still. If it helps, I don't like this any more than you do. What I really want is to extend the arrangement and to take it farther. The dejection that's consuming me eases a bit. So why can't you tell me what happened? There's no point. He glances at the window and then back at me. A member of my security team will take you to your apartment and make sure it's secure. Even so, I think you should stay with a friend, at least until the break's over, preferably longer. If a deluded fan is the one who's been targeting you, it'll give him or her time to see that we're not together anymore. My housemates are back, and the landlord is having security cameras installed. I'll be fine. Declan, who never fidgets, shifts his weight back and forth between his feet, and then runs a hand through his hair. I expect him to excuse himself and leave me standing alone, but he doesn't. He's so close I could reach out and touch him, and I want to. His tone softens and seems regretful. I'm glad you were with me this past week. His fingertips touch my face for a brief second. Then he leans forward and whispers, and of all the things I've ever owned, you were my favorite. That causes me to choke on nothing more than air. When I step back, the small smirk that's playing at the corners of his mouth makes me want to throttle him and kiss him. Yeah, same. Of all the times I've been forced to be a sex slave, this was my favorite. His smile widens, but he says, shh, I know, keep it secret, keep it safe. My tone is light and joking, but tears prickle in my eyes. And deep down, my heart aches way more than it has a right to. When we met, I wasn't ready to be with Declan. Now, I'm not ready to be without him.
Chapter 33. Declan. The day after Cameron goes home, I force myself through a grueling morning workout to take the edge off my frustration. Unfortunately, the minute I step in the shower, I'm reminded of showering with her, which sets me on edge again. I eat silently, checking the progress report I've gotten from the security officer I sent to her house. She didn't leave her apartment last night, and no one approached it. That's good, at least. Would you like me to turn on some music? Briggs asks. Without looking up, I say, if I wanted music, I'd have said so already. Briggs leaves me alone in the kitchen, which I prefer. He's been peppering me with questions and attention, which is grating. It's a reminder that I've lost something even my chef recognizes was special. There's silence for another 30 minutes as I drink coffee and wait for Shane to arrive. He's late. Briggs returns, humming as he hurriedly pulls things from the fridge. For a split second, I wonder whether Cameron is dropping by unexpectedly. Even though it's not cool for her to show up unannounced, I want to see her, so I will let her in. What are you doing, Briggs? I ask, sliding toward the end of the bench. If she's coming, I don't want her standing on the street where anyone could see her. Miss Moran texted. He'll be here in 6 minutes and was hoping for a sandwich since he missed breakfast. For the first time in my life, I'm disappointed that Shane's the person I'll be seeing rather than someone else. Setting my phone down, I narrow my eyes. Shane texted Briggs directly. What's up with that? We're leaving as soon as he gets here, I say, my tone more surly than necessary, assumed. Did you? My tone goes from cold to glacial as he hustles to heat some pulled pork and barbecue sauce. My phone buzzes at the same time the microwave dings. Shane. Here, come in or roll out. Declan. Roll out. I stand as Briggs puts some raw shredded cabbage and the pork onto a ciabatta bun and wraps it in foil. He drops it, an apple and a napkin, into a bag and falls in step with me as I head to the front door. Grabbing my coat and shrugging it on, I say, do you want me to deliver that? Not if you'd prefer not to. Exhaling a small huff, I yank the bag from his hands and walk out. Shane's vintage Porsche idles at the curb. When I open the passenger door, I toss him the bag, courtesy of Briggs. Should I drive so you can eat? Shane's brow rises. Problem? As I drop into the passenger seat, I say, if fucking Avery first thing in the morning is going to make an 8:30 meeting tough for you, we can go for 9 or 9:30 instead from now on. If not fucking Cameron Reynolds is going to make you an asshole, you can do an 8:30 drive-by to get your dick sucked, and a 9 a.m. meeting it is from now on. We glare at each other before I shake my head. Let's go. Should we make a pit stop? You can do her while I eat my sandwich. You only need 5 minutes, right? The corner of Shane's mouth curves up. I turn my head away from him to smirk. I'm not in the mood for jokes. Staring out the passenger window, I say, I'm surprised you abandoned Avery to her fate, seeing as you're more bodyguard with benefits than boyfriend. Avery isn't home alone. I left at my pop's house where we stay the night. Pops is the nickname Shane has for his grandfather. To me, it sounds too casual and cute to be used for a cutthroat mafia boss, but perhaps that's the point. It's like when a 6'7" biker is called tiny. You drove back from Boston this morning? I did. You're welcome. After a beat, I say, Avery's certainly safe in Back Bay. No one would storm that castle. No, they would not. He smiles and bites into the apple. You must have been up early to work up that appetite, I say. Man, are you serious right now? If you really want an accounting, I'll give you one. Yeah, I fucked it twice last night and once this morning. You want to know which positions? Circa freshman year of high school? My hand drops to rest on my thigh, and I brush the knee of my dark gray trousers with my thumb. No. He gives me the side eye. I don't blame him. If Cameron were here, she'd say I'm being an arrogant tool. Is there anywhere near campus I could meet a woman discreetly? No. Tipping my head back against the headrest, I scowl. I knew the answer, but I wanted a different one. The truth is, my every move is watched these days. The Hayworth Fan Club, photographers from the campus paper and farther afield, random students who have made a game of spotting GU football players all take my picture and post it online. If I want to go somewhere in secret in town, I need a body double. I could stay in my suite in the Wolf Frame. You're going back to Boston tonight, right? For Avery? You could bring Cameron to Boston for me and drop her off at the hotel before you go to Back Bay. I would if I was going back tonight, but I'm not. One of my grandfather's men is driving Avery home. She's got a meeting on campus later. But look, I can arrange for a driver to take Cameron to Boston in secret. That's easy, Deck. It's overcomplicating things, though. If I go to Boston, I could have anyone come to the hotel. My phone is full of women who would. Shane's silence causes me to glance at his profile. I just cut her loose. Things are settled. I say this out loud as a reminder to myself. Pulling the car into a parking spot outside the GU Alumni Club, Shane glances at the building and then at me. Want me to weigh in on this? I don't know. Do I? He flashes me a grin, and then his eyes bore into me. You want back-to-back national championships and walk through hell to do it? Nothing but fucking plants and seeds for 2 months, for fuck's sake. He grimaces like he's doing a shot of straight bitters. If you want Cameron Reynolds in your bed, let's make it so. You earn the right to do whatever the hell you want, man. Cameron in my bed is what I want, so fucking much it's eating my every thought. There's Tremblay, Shane says. We're on campus to see Jeff Tremblay, so neither of us hesitates. Shane and I exit the car, swinging the door shut, and walk across the grass to meet him on a path that leads to the pond. Tremblay's wearing a navy wool coat and red scarf. He greets us with a wide smile and hearty handshakes. Thanks for meeting us, I say as the three of us walk toward the pond. My uncle has been acting erratically. I know you've spent some time with him at the Boston Club. Have you noticed anything strange? Tremblay frowns.
Yeah. He's scrambling.
The older man rubs his jaw and pauses to look at a banner that has Tavi Muniz on it. There are a bunch of banners of prominent students scattered across campus. I'm on the one in front of the football stadium.
The five of us who fund the scholarships for our special girls all contribute equally, Tremblay says with one more long look at Tavi's pretty face. We all have equal access. About a year ago, Brock said he wanted to take over more administrative duties associated with the program, and in exchange, he wanted to lower his financial contribution. I didn't care, but the other three said no. Then, about 4 months ago, Brock came to me and asked me to cover his share. Whatever funds he'd been using from the Hayworth Foundation for his extracurricular activities had dried up. Some sort of stricter oversight. Tremblay pulls out a bag of bread from his pocket and tosses some to the geese. Anyway, I covered Brock's share in exchange for his promise that he'd help me get one of the girls out of the program early. I want her for myself, but I'd rather not cause an uproar. Brock had a plan to appease the others. He had this pair of beautiful, blonde, virgin twins lined up for a long weekend, and one of them was going to permanently replace the girl I want to pull out. A blonde virgin and her twin, I think grimly.
My muscles tighten reflexively. Tremblay licks his lips and cocks his head.
There's a member who loves blondes, and another who loves virgins. So everyone signed off on the plan. And we're all set.
Pocketing the empty plastic bag, he shrugs.
Then things went sideways. Brock started talking about giving the girls drugs so they wouldn't be nervous. He said they might be groggy.
Tremblay purses his lips into a grim line and shakes his head.
We've had other sugar babies who started out as virgins. We didn't medicate them or get them wasted. So why would that suddenly be necessary?
Drugged for the rape. That was my uncle's plan. The rage simmering in my blood threatens to spill over. Past girls weren't medicated that you know of. Shane says mildly,
look, if any of them took a Xanax or a shot of liquor for some liquid courage, all good. That was their choice, but we didn't drug them, and we definitely didn't fuck them while they were in a stupor.
I'm pretty certain the girls Brock planned to offer up were Cameron and Taylor Reynolds. He could certainly have passed them off as twins, and maybe Taylor could still pass as a virgin, too. As I understand it, by adulthood, plenty of virgin pussies don't have a hymen left. Did you see a picture of the girls? I ask.
Yeah.
I take out my phone and open a picture of Cameron from the shopping trip. Is this one of them?
Maybe.
Tremblay inclines his head.
Yeah. Could be. To tell you the truth, I wasn't looking that closely. I always planned to bow out, even before the drugging bullshit.
He glances at the water and shrugs.
I want the one I'm pulling out. Once I have her, I'm done with the parties.
Was there a party a couple nights ago? On the night of the championship parade, I ask, thinking about the way my uncle disappeared and about the way someone drugged Cameron with morphine. Did Brock arrange for her to be dosed? She could have been given too much accidentally. She has no tolerance, which they might not have counted on. Maybe she was supposed to become dazed and someone would have led her away, out through the South Hall. My jaw clenches. If my uncle planned to kidnap my girl right out from under me and gang rape her on the night of my victory party, I will fucking kill him.
A party here at GU? Not that I know of,
Tremblay says.
That would be really risky.
But Brock's been cagey ever since the night you walked in on the last party in the Ex-Fato Club. Most of us didn't think it was a big deal. We'd planned a wilder celebration you were invited to. If we trust each other as society members, then we trust each other.
Period.
But Brock was upset. Of course he was. Brock wanted to maintain and expand his leverage over Cameron and her sister, and not only was I uncooperative, I became a threat to his plans. I appreciate your talking to us, I say, shaking Tremblay's hand.
Yeah, of course, he says. That's the brotherhood.
The friendly expression I offer Tremblay when I say goodbye disappears as soon as I turn away. He calls the Dark Knights a brotherhood. And it should be. I don't consider it one because Brock is a part of it. With his weak character, Brock should never have been inducted. He was bound to bastardize the society's actions to suit himself. Two questions burn in my mind now. Do I cut ties with the Dark Knights, despite swearing an oath of lifetime membership, or am I willing to do whatever it takes to remove Brock from the group? Good luck getting your girl, Shane says to Tremblay.
Thanks, but I don't need luck. I'm widowed, not married. I can pull out all the stops. I'm taking her to Vienna to meet her favorite conductor, and I've arranged an infusion of cash into her family's struggling restaurant.
His flash of a smile is so wide he looks almost boyish.
I'm about to prove I'm all the sugar daddy she needs.
Starting again on the path around the pond, he calls over his shoulder,
"Have a good afternoon, gentlemen."
It's always good when a man resolves to go after what he wants. I picture Cameron's beautiful lips and the way they turned blue when she stopped breathing. Never again. An icy resolve forms inside me, ending the dilemma over which Hayworth will get to retain Dark Knight's membership. As Shane and I stand alone in the cold wind, he glances at me. His eyes are sharp and focused. So, should we ask Uncle Brock who he got to drop something in Cammy's drink?
Yes, I say.
And I should ask him what really happened on the night my mom died, since it'll be my last chance to hear what he knows. The last chance, huh? Shane steps in front of me and lowers his chin, as though he's studying the paved path. Is that something you want me to handle? Shane understands my intention and isn't fazed by it. Outwardly, we seem alike. Wealthy families, same education. But we're different. He's been groomed to use violence to end conflicts. That's not my usual strategy. But this time, it's warranted. Not alone, I say softly. It probably should be me alone, Deck. Our eyes meet for a second. For the reasons we've talked about in the past, it's important to keep your image clean. This is Dark Knight's business, and Brock's my uncle. I won't ask you to take care of the situation for me. His eyes rise to meet mine again. You didn't ask. I'm offering. Together, I say softly, turning my hand over to reveal the scar that came from the time we made a blood pact. Before the Knights, we were a two-man brotherhood. Let's run it back. Chapter 34. Declan. Brock is running scared or hiding out. In a move that reminds me of a weasel scenting larger predators nearby, my uncle has seemingly gone to ground. Having vacated Boston, he isn't answering calls, texts, or emails. My aunt says he's not at home in New York and claims he's on a business trip. She denies knowing the city he's in, which clinches it. They're playing games. His wife may not know what he gets up to at the Dark Knights Alumni Club, but she always knows which city Brock is in at any given moment. It would have been more convenient if he hadn't decided to disappear, but no matter where he's gone, we'll eventually track him down. The late afternoon sun is low on the horizon as I drive to the waterfront. I'm headed to a small, ramshackle area that feels deserted. Half a mile away, on either side, there are bustling construction sites, but this is one of the few areas that has escaped change. As I approach, I spot an old manufacturing plant, which looks grimly industrial from the rust patina on its corrugated metal roof and siding. Part of the building is red brick, but it's been so battered and coated with soot that it looks charcoal brown. I drive until I see Eric's SUV. It's been a year since he moved into a converted loft inside. My first impression of the place was that it was unlivable, but he just shook his head at my skepticism, saying he'd already signed a lease. Emerging from my car to the smell of seawater, I draw in a deep breath. The rocky river's edge smells of fish and gulls and algae. I prefer the open ocean, but even here a part of me feels at home. From childhood on, my summers were spent on or near the water, and that comes with the smell of life and death. The building has two floors, and when I enter, I find that the downstairs has been cleared of dirt and dust, but is still a wreck of a space. It's filled with rusted equipment and battered work tables. A pile of old chains sits coiled in the corner like a massive snake. Taking the exposed metal staircase up to Eric's apartment, my feet bang loudly against the stairs